You are listening to continuing coverage of the trial of Chad Daybell from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Let's go back to the courtroom.
Doctor, upon completion of your autopsy of Tylee Ryan, what did you do or did your lab do with her remains?
So after we collected and cleaned the bony remains, we sent all of the bones to the FBI for a detailed forensic anthropology report. We had them analyze it and produce a report.
All right. And did you review that report?
I did.
Okay. And did that report take any part in your findings or decision regarding Tylee Ryan's cause of death?
I think every information, I took into account. The report on this came back as they noted, and we noted also before, that there were sharp force markings on the bones, but they really detailed and took photographs of sharp force markings that were found on the sacrum and also on the right and left pelvic bone. So yes, it did play a role, and I did not sign out the case or come to my conclusion until I had all the information back.
Okay. And you did already answer this question yesterday, but because of the time, I would just ask you again, based on your autopsy and your training and education, what was your opinion concerning the cause of death of Tylee Ryan?
I determined the cause of death to be homicide by unspecified means.
Thank you. And just for purposes of clarity, can you remind the jury the criteria for a homicide by unspecified means?
Yes. So as we talked about yesterday, there's guidelines and criteria to go over briefly, just to remind you. One, it has to be objectively suspicious findings. So some of the examples they give is that the body is hidden out of plain view, say in a trunk of a car or in the forest and covered by branches, or buried in the ground. Another example is that evidence was attempted or evidence was concealed, right? So they were lit on fire. They were dismembered. Bleach was poured on them, something of that nature. So for criteria number one, this case clearly falls into that, fitting both of those criteria. For number two, it's the autopsy doesn't show an obvious cause of death or a better explanation for the cause of death. And the two examples they give there is, one, you have an intact body, you're able to examine it, look at all the organs, and you can't come up with the cause of death. The other example is that there's not enough of the body there for you to determine what the cause of death is. So Tylee would fit under that category. The third criteria is toxicology. That toxicology cannot explain why the decedent is dead. In this case, there was nothing in Tylee's toxicology where I felt I could explain her death. And then the fourth criteria is more based on history and some of the circumstances surrounding the death, the medical records. And we went over Tylee's medical records yesterday, and I didn't think there was a good explanation why otherwise young, healthy teenager would be dead. So those are the guidelines and the criteria I use to come to my conclusion.
Thank you. Your Honor, at this point, I have no further questions.
All right. Before you step away from the podium there, Mr. Wood, I do just want to note on the record the exhibits that were admitted, we referenced them as 176 A through MM and 177 A through EE. And I will note there are certain portions that are not included in. I guess what I'm saying is there are some missing letters within the sub-exhibits in what I'm seeing with my courtesy copies.
Your Honor, we initially had more pictures and then limited what we were going to show to the jury based on what needed to be shown to explain the testimony.
Okay, so this might be tedious for a moment, but in order to keep the record clear, I'd like to go just read in individually those and make sure they track with the state's actual exhibits so that we do have the record of what was admitted on those. So starting with 176, we've got A, 176 B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, X, Y, then we've got 176 B, B, C, C, D, D, E, E, F, F, G, G, H, H, I, J, J, L, L, and M, M.
In your honor, is that the court's courtesy copy or the exhibit copy?
That's the court's courtesy copy.
Okay. Did the court have 176 AA?
We do have AA. I may have misread that. So AA is also in there.
And it sounded like there was one missing, BB.
BB is there also.
Okay.
On 177, maybe it'd be easier to just say I had A through EE, and the ones I saw were not included. If you went alphabetically, would be there was no L, R, U, W, or Y. N. Oh, and also no N.
That tracks with the copy I have, Your Honor. And again, there were some photographs that we deemed unnecessary to put on, but they'd already been marked.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify so that neither the jurors nor somebody looking at the record was wondering where those were. They were not included or admitted. So thanks for addressing that. That will conclude then the direct examination of Dr. Warren. Mr. Pryor, once you're ready, you can go to the podium and conduct cross-examination.
Good morning, Dr. Warren.
Good morning.
As part of your review of the anthropology report, did you note that there were some canine bites of any time on any parts of the remains of Tylee?
I did not notice that on my examination, but I'd probably leave that up to the anthropologist.
Now, you talked previously about bruising and that you do a cut to determine whether or not it was actual bruise or not an actual bruise. But isn't it true there's really no way to determine on any bruise when the bruise occurred, is there?
It's difficult to get exact timing on a bruise. That is true. They've even done studies where they've looked at it under the microscope and tried to, you know, really pinpoint the time frame. And it is difficult. Some of the things you can look at are color of the bruise. So typically a fresh bruise is going to be blue, red, purple. As it gets older, it's going to turn brown, green, yellow. And then under the microscope, it usually takes several minutes for inflammation to come in. So if you take a section under the microscope and there's no inflammation, you can presumably say that it was fairly recent before the death. But yes, it is difficult to time bruises and abrasions postmortem.
So if some time had passed, and let's even say that some time had passed, And it was a situation where there was embalming fluid put in the body and a significant amount of time had passed on bruising. Would it be fair to say that at that point, there'd be real no way to determine what kind of bruising or how to date those bruisings?
Again, you know, as I stated before, it's difficult to get an exact time of a bruise. You can give a time frame. I mean, there's definitely a difference between a fresh bruise and a bruise that's a week old, right? By the look at it under the microscope.
In this particular case, on the arms, I took sections of the bruising and looked under the microscope. And what I saw was hemorrhage and no inflammation.
Okay.
So to me, what that means is that it was, probably right around, close to around the time that JJ passed away, because you do need some time for inflammation to come in. But I did not see that on JJ.
Okay.
And Dr. Warren, would you maybe just pull that microphone down about 2 or 3 inches downwards? If it's more under your mouth, I think it picks it up better.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's fine. Thank you.
But again, in general, when you're talking about bruising, one of the immediate ways to determine the age of a bruise is that if, let's say, a bruise was brown or brownish, greenish, that would seem to suggest, at least generally, that that was an older bruise. Would that be fair?
That's correct.
Okay. And even if you dug into that bruise and you saw that there was hemorrhaging, that doesn't necessarily give you the ability to determine when that bruise was placed on the body or occurred. Is that fair?
I think it's fair to say it's difficult to determine the exact time of the bruise. It's more of a range.
Now, you spoke about examining Tylee's medical records, and you were able to determine that she was a healthy young girl at the time that this occurred. And she was approximately how tall, do you recall?
Well, I wasn't able to get a height at my examination because of the condition of the body.
But in looking at the medical records, were you able to obtain that information?
I don't remember off the top of my head how tall Tylee was.
Okay. Now, your examination cannot make a determination as to when the remains were put in the ground. Is that fair?
Yes, that's correct.
And even in spite of the anthropologist report and your examination, the fragments that you found in the fire pit, you can't make a determination as to whether or not those were animal or human fragments in the fire pit. Is that right?
I'm not a forensic anthropologist, so okay. I can't. I would not feel comfortable doing that.
Okay.
But that's the whole reason why I sent it to a specialist, a forensic anthropologist. Okay. So I think that's a better question for the forensic anthropologist.
And we should rely on a forensic anthropologist to make that determination. Would that be fair?
Yes.
Along with potential DNA evidence?
I think DNA specialists should make determination on DNA.
Do you have a recollection of when the date of these two autopsies took place? Specific date?
Yes. So June 11th, 2020.
And the one you said took over a week, so that would have extended on through the 17th or 18th?
That's correct.
There is a term called heavy lungs. Do you recognize that term?
Heavy lungs is sometimes a term used when there's pulmonary edema. So pulmonary edema is when there's an excess amount of fluid in the lungs. You can get pulmonary edema for a wide variety of reasons. For instance, you can get it in congestive heart failure. Your heart isn't pumping as well as it should. Everything kind of backs up. Fluid leaks into the lungs. You get heavy lungs. You get pulmonary edema.
Okay. And as a matter of record, you can get that pulmonary edema from the heart not operating properly, and for all practical purposes, the heart could look perfectly normal. Isn't that correct?
Your Honor, I'm going to object. There was no testimony earlier about heavy lungs. This is beyond the scope of Dr. Warren's testimony.
Sustained.
Would you agree with me that the remains that were presented to you were significantly smaller than the remains of Tylee had she been alive at that time?
Again, I think that's probably a better question for the forensic anthropologist.
Okay.
I mean, I think it's safe to say that I can say that we received Tylee and she was dismembered in multiple parts. So obviously, yes, it's going to be shorter than if she was intact, but what that means, or I'm not sure. I think I'd rather leave that question to a forensic anthropologist.
And from your examination, the vital organs were significantly smaller than what they would have been of a normal breathing human being, correct?
That's correct. That's very common in fire-related deaths, and the organs get charred. They shrink. They shrink, and they lose weight.
Okay. Judge, I don't think I have anything else. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Any redirect from the state?
Just very briefly, Your Honor. Doctor, you were asked about the dating of bruises.
Yes.
Is bruising, can bruising be considered a form of trauma?
Yes.
And in a situation in which you viewed the remains of J.J. Vallow, would you be surprised to find bruising on that body?
I think any bruising or any injuries in a case like this is very significant.
That's it, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. That'll conclude then testimony of Dr. Warren. We'll make sure the exhibits are given to the clerk here. And is Dr. Warren going to be recalled, do you think, at any point by the state?
Your Honor, it's not likely. I guess it's possible in rebuttal, but I guess the state would just keep him under subpoena for the time being.
Okay. So, Dr. Warren, since you're under subpoena, there's an exclusionary order prohibiting you from viewing testimony. This case is available to see streamed live or here in the courtroom, so please don't do anything to view any testimony in case you are recalled or until you are advised you've been released from any subpoena in the court.
Okay.
Thank you for your testimony. Go ahead and step down.
All right, thank you.
Your Honor, if I may, I believe there are certain portions of testimony Dr. Warren would be allowed to watch if they were presented.
Okay.
Judge, could we
approach? We can clear that up later.
Yeah, that's...
Could we have a sidebar on this?
Yeah, and I'll just, before we have sidebar, point out that's a proper argument Mr. Woods brought up, that the exclusionary order does not necessarily apply at times in certain aspects to what are considered expert witnesses. So you can go ahead and step down. We'll have a sidebar, and then you can call the next witness, the state. And who will the next witness be?
Your Honor, the state needed just a moment with regards to the next witness as well and was actually going to ask for a sidebar.
Okay, let's have that sidebar. All right, we had a sidebar. There's an exhibit that the state's going to be proposing with the next witness, and the exhibit is in electronic format, and counsel for defense does need an opportunity to review the exhibit because apparently it's had some modifications since it was first reviewed by defense counsel. Because of the nature of the exhibit, what we discussed, just the most simple way to take care of that is we are going to have another break at this time to clear the courtroom so that defense counsel can review the exhibit in preparation for its being proffered. And so we'll take a break to take up this evidentiary issue, and then we'll come back on with the calling of the next witness.
All right. Mr. Court's again in session.
All right. Thank you. Please be seated. Counsel, before we go on the record, are we ready to proceed? You able to review the exhibit with counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. We're ready. We're ready to proceed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Let's go ahead and bring the jurors in, please.
All right, please. Jurors are present. Counsel for Your Honor.
Thank you. Please be seated. Okay, we're back on the record on case CR 22-21-1623, State of Idaho versus Chad Guy Daybell. The state's getting prepared to call its next witness. Because I will likely forget to mention this before we call the witness, just a scheduling matter, I'd like to advise the court, everyone here, and the jurors as well. Tomorrow, there are some courthouse renovations taking place that are probably going to be pretty distracting when that happens. So we've had a request to stop trial tomorrow at 2:00. So we'll talk about a schedule, possibly with a shorter lunch tomorrow, going through, but we'll need to conclude by 2:00 tomorrow. So that will be the schedule, and then we'll have likely another just normal day on Friday. So apologies for doing that a strange time. And again, I don't think I'll remember to do that otherwise. At this time, the state, I believe, Ms. Blake, you're going to be directing the next witness. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Go ahead and call your witness, please.
The state will call Detective Werther.
Always swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help you God.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. I'll note Detective Werther's now been placed under oath. I do have a couple of questions before we commence. Detective Werther, have you listened in on online or in person here any of the trial testimony that's taken place since this case started?
I have not.
Have you talked to anyone else about testimony they've provided in this trial?
I spoke to Detective Duncan. I'm aware that he did testify, but we didn't discuss the content of his testimony.
Okay. All right. Ms. Blake, then you may proceed with your direct.
Thank you, Your Honor. Will you please state your name again and spell it for the record?
Yes. My name is Ariel Werther. Ariel spelled A-R-I-E-L. Werther spelled W-E-R-T-H-E-R. My badge number is 649, and I work for the Chandler Police Department.
What is your current title or position within the Chandler Police Department?
The title is detective. I'm assigned to the robbery homicide unit of the Chandler Police Department.
Do you have any specialized training in order to be a law enforcement officer in general?
Yes, I attended the Arizona Law Enforcement Academy 2011. Prior to that, I worked as a dispatcher for the department for 3 years. And then since that time, I've engaged in ongoing training as required by AZ Post, which is the outfit that determines if a person is and can remain a sworn law enforcement officer in Arizona. I've also sought additional specialized training for the various units that I've worked in, including training relevant to what I'm testifying here today.
And you just talked about some of them, but have you held various assignments or positions within the Chandler Police Department?
I have. So initially, I began, as I mentioned, as a police dispatcher, the civilian position, answering 911, dispatching police officers, things like that. That was in 2008. In 2011, I transitioned and became a sworn law enforcement officer, went to the academy. I worked on patrol for a total of 5 years. During two of those years, I was a field training officer, which would be a person who trains new officers in the job on in the field. And then I transitioned to working as a detective for the Special Victims Unit, investigating primarily sex crimes and family violence cases. And then that was in 2016. In 2020, I transitioned to working for the Robbery Homicide Unit, and I've been there since.
And then you referenced some training regarding what you're testifying to today. Can you tell me a little bit about what that training was or is?
I've attended multiple training events regarding the interpretation of cell phone records specifically, including two 40-hour courses, one of which I attended earlier this year. And that provides training and guidance and practical experience, including projects that one works on in the class, in order to properly interpret data received from cell phone service providers. And then I've also had training on interpreting data extracted from mobile devices.
So focusing on that training with the cell phones, can you explain how a cell phone communicates with cell towers?
A mobile device on a cellular network would typically be serviced by a particular provider. That provider has a network of base stations or cell towers. We've all seen them as we move throughout the city and other places. Those have radio frequency antenna mounted to them that angle in particular directions and broadcast and receive signals that keep your mobile device communicating with the network. And the typically, if you are moving about, it may be the case that your device may begin connected to a particular cell tower, but then do what's known as a handoff and transition to a different cellular tower on the same network in order to provide what feels to us like an uninterrupted experience as it moves from one tower to the next.
And do you use call detail records to get information about a cell phone as well?
We do.
What is a call detail record?
Call detail records is a generic term for the records maintained by your cellular service provider that they maintain for their own purposes, for business purposes, and that log things such as when a particular mobile device connected to a tower, for what purpose. If it's a voice call, typically it'll say, you know, the length of that call. And if it's a text message, it'll typically tell you things such as whether that's an incoming or an outgoing text message and what other phone numbers were involved in that communication.
How does law enforcement obtain call detail records?
Typically via a search warrant based upon probable cause and authorized by a judge, which is then served to the cellular service provider, and then they will produce the records ordered by that judge.
Were you working in Chandler, Arizona on July 11th of 2019?
I was.
Did you end up responding out to a call regarding a shooting?
I did.
Were you the lead investigator at that time?
I was not.
What were your responsibilities? Well, let me back up. Did you learn who the victim of that shooting was?
Yes.
And who was that?
That was Charles Vallow.
Were you assigned certain roles or responsibilities on July 11th of 2019?
I was.
What were those?
They were minimal at that time. As I mentioned before, I joined the robbery homicide team in 2020. So I was not on the team at this point. And as this was a fatal shooting investigation, that's the team that would respond out. I was at that time still in Special Victims Unit, but I had made no secret of the fact that I intended to test for the robbery homicide team in the near future. So as a matter of succession planning, I was invited to come out on various incidents that would be good training opportunities for me to see how the investigation was conducted. All of that is to say that much of my time at the scene was actually observing and not actually directly handling any particular responsibility.
At some point, were you given cell phone location data to review and analyze?
I was.
Do you know whose cell phone data that was?
Yes.
And whose was it?
That was data extracted from a device belonging to Charles Vallow.
As part of your role in the investigation, did you review phone or call detail records in relation to other phones?
I did.
Do you recall the various providers that you looked at records from?
Yes.
And who were those?
Those were T-Mobile, Verizon, and AT&T.
Do the records from all of the providers look the same?
They do not.
And can you explain a little bit about how they differ?
Each provider has their own, because again, these are maintained for their business records. They're not, law enforcement doesn't instruct them what data they have to keep. We can merely access the data that they do have. So each company has a different approach to how they maintain their data for their own purposes. Some are in spreadsheets, some are in text documents, some are multiple spreadsheets, some are much more consolidated. We take the data as they have it and analyze what they give us.
And in this case, were you the officer that drafted any of the search warrants for these call records?
No.
Did somebody else draft the search warrants?
That's right.
And then you were provided the data, the responsive data to analyze?
That's correct.
And did that include analyzing GPS?
It did include analyzing GPS location data, which was extracted from Charles Vallow's phone.
Is it fair to call the call detail records raw data?
Yes.
And do you use a program to analyze that data once you have it?
Yes. The Chandler Police Department has access to a program called Trax, formerly under a company called ZX, but they've transitioned to a company called LexisNexis. But the tool is a data analysis tool that we're able to use to analyze raw records that we are given by the companies.
And can you explain a little bit about how that program interprets the data to get a location of a cell phone?
Yes. You were, as mentioned previously, your device connects to various towers as you use voice, data, text, whatever you may be using. And we request and obtain from the providers locations of the towers and details about the tower. Typically, a tower is going to have multiple sectors. So while you have one tower, ordinarily that tower has antenna facing in sectors divided up to provide 360-degree coverage. The data they provide indicates the azimuth, which is a fancy term for the 360-degree angle if you were looking down on the tower from above, that particular sector is facing, and then they provide the GPS location of where that tower is located in the world. And the call detail records will typically indicate when a particular communication event took place, which tower it connected to, and which sector. Using that data, then one can get a general coverage area for where the device was most likely to have been at that time.
And when you talk about this program Trax, I think you also mentioned ZX. Is that what it used to be?
Yes, that was the company that initially developed it, I believe.
Is that program only available to law enforcement?
No, it's my understanding that it's available to paying customers who want to use it for various purposes. I'm familiar with instances where it's been used by defense and people doing private analysis.
In your experience, do cell phone companies use technology that looks for the best signal?
Typically. So as I mentioned before, you may start a call in one place and you either may move or you may not for one reason or another. during the course of that call, your device could switch to a different tower because the signal's better. Environmental conditions can impact signal strength, line of sight, obstructions in the environment, and then again, when we move and our devices move with us.
And to be clear, when we talk about the location of a device, that's the cell phone itself, not necessarily the person it's associated with. Is that correct?
Correct. Call detail records can tell you information about where a device most likely was at a given moment. The question of who's holding the device is something that must be examined or determined from context or other means.
And we've talked about in this particular case, you were given some phone records to review.
Yes.
Do you recall what you looked at in this case?
I do.
And what was that?
So there were records of four different phone numbers, again, between Verizon, T-Mobile, AT&T, that were attributed to various people involved in this investigation. Again, I did not write the warrants to obtain that data. I was just given the data after it had been obtained.
When you're provided phone records, what are you looking for?
So typically, what I want to determine if there are claims that have been made in this investigation or are relevant to the investigation that could possibly be tested by the data set that I've been given. There are certain questions that your cell phone data set might be able to answer and certain questions that they cannot. So if, for example, someone said that in a room with just the two of you there, you said a particular thing, I'm unlikely to find an answer to that in your cell phone data records. It's not likely to be there. But as far as analyzing when and where people tended to be or if they were in fact communicating without necessarily knowing what they communicated about, those are things that one can evaluate. So you look at the records and try to determine by looking at them if there are reasonable conclusions that can be reached from what's in that data set that would be relevant to your case.
And in this case, did you prepare an exhibit of the information you reviewed?
I did.
And was the information you reviewed extensive?
Yes.
Do you feel that the exhibit would aid you in your testimony today?
It would.
Do you feel it would aid the jurors in understanding the evidence you're going to talk about?
I do believe it would.
Your Honor, I have what's been marked as State's Exhibit 43. However, I had talked with counsel in the court before. I have it plugged into my laptop ready to play. It does take a minute to upload. Counsel has been provided a copy. I would ask to publish at least the first slide of it for identification purposes.
Okay. If there's no objection, then we'll go ahead and permit you to publish that first slide. And I'll note also we did provide time for defense counsel to review this on the break. So you can do that, Ms. Blake.
And I will indicate there should be a mouse up on the stand for the detective to use as we get further.
I think also we would have the option here to just put that on the witness's monitor and not publish to the jurors. Is that preference yours?
For identification purposes, the first slide does not contain much information. It does contain some phone numbers, however, that were analyzed.
Okay. Well, we can just go ahead and publish that on the big screen then also. And I don't think that would be a problem if the jurors viewed that.
And Detective Werther, do you recognize the slide we're seeing on the screen?
I do.
Was this in fact prepared by you?
It was.
And did you and I meet yesterday to review the exhibit as well?
Yes.
And was it an accurate copy of what you created?
Yes, that's right.
Your Honor, I would move for the admission of State's Exhibit 43.
Any objection?
There's no objection, Judge.
Oh, very well. Exhibit 43 is entered. And as it's an electronic type exhibit, Ms. Blake, if you could just describe a little bit for the record what the exhibit is.
Yes, Your Honor. The exhibit is a PowerPoint. I believe it contains approximately 128 slides. I know it's 120-something slides, as well as a few embedded things as well.
Okay, thank you.
And Detective Werther, on this first slide, do you see some phone numbers listed?
I do.
And you previously mentioned that you looked at four call detail records for four numbers.
That's right.
Are those the four numbers that you looked at detail records for?
Those are the four numbers. And then that last item mentions Charles Vallow's phone extraction. That's because, as I mentioned before, that's data taken directly from the device, not from a cell phone service provider.
Okay. And as we start moving through this, what are we seeing? Actually, let me back up. What records were you given? Are those what were depicted on the first slide?
Yes, and the slides that follow will show them again as well.
What are we seeing on this first slide?
This is just to orient the viewer or the reader that my analysis pertains to Chandler Police Department's investigation numbered 2019-83744, a shooting investigation in the city of Chandler in Arizona that occurred on July 11th, 2019. This is a CAD call. CAD call is a computer-aided dispatch call, which is what's sent to the officers to notify them they need to go to a place for a particular reason. And it shows the time that the call to 911 was received was 8:36. And a dispatcher or a call taker entered the initial comments here, RP shot brother-in-law. This call was made by Alex Cox.
And what would RP stand for?
Reporting party.
And if we move to the next slide. And on this slide, what are we seeing here?
This represents the records that I was given and that I used in this analysis for a particular phone number, that phone number being 808-755-5452, which is a Verizon number. And when it was given to me, it was attributed to being a phone used by Lori Vallow.
And if we move forward, and our, what are we seeing on this slide?
This is the same sort of breakdown. And I should have mentioned each of those line items that one reads on these slides. Those are the titles of the documents I was given pertaining to the particular record. So this is a T-Mobile phone number, 480-692-9562, also attributed to Lori Vallow.
So this is a second device attributed to Lori Vallow that you looked at?
Correct. And one thing I noticed, and I've noted it here when I received these records, no logs of text messages were received, received by me. Ordinarily, your call detail records include not only the voice calls that you make and receive or that your device makes and receives, but also any text messages sent for whatever reason. And I don't know what it is. I did not receive text message logs pertaining to this number.
And then if we move forward, what are we seeing on this slide?
This tells you of the records from Verizon for number 480-351-9120 attributed to Alex Cox. And again, a listing of the documents that I received for this analysis.
And then if we move forward from there, what are we seeing on this slide?
This is a listing of AT&T documents pertaining to number 515-402-0143. And when I was provided these records, I was told that they were attributed to Chad Daybell.
And when you looked at these particular records, did you notice who it appeared that the phone attributed to Chad Daybell had been in contact with?
I did notice various communications between this and primarily one other number on the day in question.
And what other number was that?
The primary number was one of the two numbers attributed to Ms. Lori Vallow. It's shown throughout the slides as to which of those two particular numbers it was.
And when you talk about on the day in question, what specific day did you look at these call details for?
I mostly limited my analysis to the day of the shooting in Chandler, as that was my task to analyze what these records could tell us about that particular event. So that previously mentioned July 11th of 2019.
And then if we move forward, you'd previously mentioned that you looked at the locations extracted from Charles Vallow's phone. Is that correct?
Correct.
Did you look at any other data in relation to Charles' phone at that time?
No.
And can you remind us again or explain the difference between the records for Charles' phone versus those for Lori, Alex, and Chad?
Yes. So all of the four numbers that we've gone through, those are records. As I mentioned, a warrant was sent to a cell phone service provider, and then they provided in return various records related to their customer and that particular device and what it was doing during the time frame authorized. This is different in kind. This is data extracted from Mr. Vallow's mobile device. And that data, as I understand, is primarily sourced from GPS, which is a different system than when you're device is communicating with a cell phone tower.
And if we move to the next one, what are we seeing on this slide?
So this is to help orient the viewer to how this is going to be represented, this data from Charles' device. So we have the ability at the department, I'm not one of the people who does it, to extract data directly from someone's device. And then that data produced as a spreadsheet that was given to me can be mapped. GPS coordinates, same as we all use if you've ever used a mapping device on your phone to be able to get from one place to another. That sort of data is the type of data we're talking about. And in the presentation, the data from the phone extraction for Charles Vowell will be represented as points, as you see on the screen, in red. And that point represents the latitude, longitude that was extracted from the device.
And the red specifically will be in reference to Charles Vallow's phone?
Correct. I've color-coded the individuals associated with this, their devices, so that it helps the viewer to keep track of which device we're looking at a given point.
And if we move forward to slide 10, what are we seeing on this slide?
This is to help, again, orient what you're about to see. These are cell site markers. So we have Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile up on the screen. And when a cell site or a cell tower was indicated in the records as having communicated with the given device, they've been color-coded. So blue for Lori Vallow, yellow for Chad Daybell's device, and green for Alex Cox's device. And the tower will be represented by that color-coded pin.
And if we move forward to the next slide, what are we seeing on this slide?
This slide, again, shows the various devices, and it shows the color coding of what's known as an H-plane, which I'll discuss in more detail on the next slide, but it shows that that color coding will be maintained for those as well.
And then if we move to slide 12, and I think you said you'd discuss the H-plane a little bit more. Can you explain what we're seeing on this slide and what the H-plane is?
H-plane is short for horizontal plane. And as I mentioned before, towers have sectors and the records indicate a device communicated with a particular sector. So as you see, that black dot is the location of the cell site with which the device was communicating. And the line is the azimuth or the direction that the antenna was oriented on that sector that the device communicated with. This particular shape is an estimate of how the radio frequencies that are broadcast from that particular sector would propagate. So testing that's been done in a thing called an anechoic chamber, which is basically a room, the purpose of which is to dampen sound and radio frequencies to dampen their reflection off of objects and so forth, has allowed engineers to determine approximately the shape in which those radio frequencies are broadcast from a particular sector. Now, that would be under laboratory circumstances. The real world is not a laboratory circumstance. So this is a representation of what one would expect in a laboratory from the performance of that sector. It's important to understand this is not where you see this color-coded shaded area. This is where the device is most likely to have been for that event, but it is not a claim that the device had to be within that area or definitely was within that area. It's an estimate of a likely location.
And then if we move forward to the next slide, what are we seeing on this slide?
This is again to orient us to what we're going to view throughout most of the exhibit. So in producing the exhibit using Google Earth Pro with processed records that can be mapped and viewed in Google Earth Pro, there are certain features that one should be aware of. This top thing in Google Earth Pro is known as a timeline slider bar, and it allows one to move forward and back in time through the records and indicates at what point in time one's currently looking. Then this shaded area, as I mentioned before, is the estimated device location for one of the devices mapped in blue. This one is for one of the devices mapped in green. If you have multiple devices, they'll both be on the screen at the same time with their estimated locations. And then the red points there is an estimated location of the extracted GPS data from Charles Vallow's phone.
And what are we seeing on this next slide?
Just in order to reduce clutter on the screen, I've used shorthand. In this case, everyone has different initials, so that seemed a reasonable way to do it. So where you see CV, that refers to Charles Vallow. Where you see LV, that refers to Lori Vallow. CD refers to Chad Daybell, and AC refers to Alex Cox with their various color coding. Again, just to reduce clutter.
And then what are we going to see on these next slides?
These next slides will start bringing us into representations of the actual analysis of these various records when they're all put together.
What are we seeing on this slide?
Yes, thank you. So this was, as mentioned before, I provide some of this information on July 11th, 2019, 8:36 a.m. Chandler Police received the 911 call regarding a shooting alleged to have been in self-defense at 5531 South Four Peaks Place in Chandler. Police officers responded. They contacted Alex Cox at that location and found Charles Vallow inside, deceased, with multiple gunshot wounds. And during the course of the investigation, Lori Vallow returned to the scene at 8:48 in the morning with her daughter, Tylee Ryan. Interviews were conducted with the various people involved, and then cell provider location data, as we've discussed, was later obtained, and the cell phone location data was extracted from Charles Vallow's phone.
And if we move forward, what does this slide depict?
As I mentioned before, when you have a certain amount of information about a case and then you have the data set, the question is, what can that data set possibly tell me? Does it support the claims? Does it refute the claims? Or does it tell me nothing about the claims? These are some of the things that I noted that seemed like they could be tested by looking at the data. So some of these claims include things like the particular time that Charles Vallow was said to have arrived at the South Four Peaks Drive location, the question of whether Lori Vallow was or was not present at the time of the shooting, whether she did in fact end up with his cellular phone after the shooting, which is a claim that was made, whether the children were present, and then events after the shooting, the claim had been made by Lori that she went to a nearby Burger King and that she went to a drugstore to buy flip-flops for herself and the children. She said they had to leave without shoes because of the event, and that she dropped JJ off at Lauren's Life Academy, which is a school that he attended, and then returned after doing all those things. And one other thing is she had made the claim that Alex called Lori after the shooting and they discussed whether he would call 911 or not.
So those are all things that you felt you could try to verify or disprove in looking at the various events and timeline given?
Yes, these seem like things that cell phone estimated locations and also communication records should be able to at least give some indication of whether these things were supported or refuted by the data.
And if we move forward, were you looking to corroborate or find something that would refute some of the information provided?
Yes. Yeah, so specifically with reference to the cell phone, the call detail records from the various providers and also locations on Charles's phone, it's important not to take those things at case value and say, well, the data says that the device was there, so it absolutely had to be there because the data has an error rate. All data has an error rate. So one of the other things we try to do when we're doing investigations is find other means of corroborating or refuting the data, because if the data are not accurate, we want to know that. And so we are looking for other things that might show. And throughout the presentation, I try to intersperse some of those things that we found.
And regarding the records you received, what is the first thing you did with the records?
The first thing that I did with the records when I received them is look through the actual raw records and see what sort of records even I had been given, and notice certain things like, again, the lack of text detail for Lori. And so I asked if that was somewhere else and determined that for one reason or another, and I don't know why we don't have it. So after looking through the records, I used that program we discussed previously to produce a file that can be viewed in Google Earth Pro, so that I can put all of the various data sets alongside one another in a timeline mapped, and then move through them and see what each of the data sets indicates about what the device was likely doing during that time.
And again, was your analysis restricted to the events of July 11th of 2019?
Yes, it was.
Were the records set to a specific time?
Yes, because we were investigating an incident in Arizona, they're all interpreted in Arizona. Typically, when they provide the records from the subscribers, they're going to set them to GMT, Greenwich Mean Time, also known as Zulu time sometimes. Arizona is always 7 hours behind that, so all of these records are set to GMT minus 7, and that includes the records for Chad Daybell, which indicate that, in fact, he was in Idaho at the time, which is a different time zone. But in order to be able to see them all as they actually happened, I set his records to Arizona time. Otherwise, what you would see is all the Arizona events, and then 1 hour later, you'd see an Idaho time event that in reality had happened 1 hour earlier. It would be very confusing.
And if we move forward, is this an animation you created?
Yes.
And can you explain what we're seeing here?
The purpose of this animation is to orient the viewer to the general areas that are going to be involved in this analysis. So that's the Phoenix metro area. Chandler's on the left-hand side. You'll see the map pop up again as the data loads. And then certain areas of particular interest to the case are being labeled as we watch for reference to get you a general idea of where they're all located.
And there's a residence there. It looks like a house icon.
Yes.
What does that represent?
The one on the left side of the screen, because I've used two house icons. The one on the left is 5531 South Four Peaks Place, which is the incident location of the shooting. And I should mention, although it's likely obvious, that north is the top of the screen and it will remain so throughout the animations.
And then the other residence that we see there?
That is Alex Cox's residence at, oh, that should not have done that. Alex Cox's residence at 1658 East Shari Street in Santan Valley.
And there are some other...
Yep, Santan Valley.
And there are some other icons there. Are we going to talk more about those a little later?
We will talk about those locations as they come up.
And if we move forward?
Yes, I think we should. Oh, there we are.
And what are we seeing on this screen?
This is an estimate of the distance from the 5531 South Four Peaks Place address to a Burger King that wound up becoming an area of relevance. And the estimated distance is 1.96 miles.
And if we go to the... And is that the measurement that was depicted on that screen?
That is the measurement depicted on that screen, yes.
And on this next one, what are we seeing here?
This is an estimated distance from the Four Peaks Place address to Lauren's Life Academy, which, as I previously mentioned, is the school that JJ attended at the time. The measurement depicted on the screen is an estimate that says 7.2 miles.
And if we move to the next one, what are we seeing here again?
This again is that CAD call hard copy showing that the 911 call was received at 8:36.
And if we go to the next slide, did issues of timing and what was reported as far as times cause concern early on in the investigation?
Yes, we pretty quickly noticed there's an issue of plausibility as far as the timeline. If the 911 call was received at 8:36, and if Lori returned to Four Peaks at 8:48, which is 12 minutes later, you notice you have to go about a little over a mile to go to the Burger King and then 7 miles round trip to go to the academy, added in the claim that there was a stop at a drugstore. We began to become concerned about a delay in calling 911, which is ordinarily concerning. Ordinarily, if a shooting event happens, 911 is normally called relatively quickly.
And I think I'd failed to ask, did Lori report that she'd stopped at that Burger King?
She did.
And then that she'd taken JJ to school?
Yes, and I should clarify, I spoke to her. She told me she stopped at a Burger King. I'm not positive she specified that one.
Was that one on the way to JJ's school?
Yes, I think it's the nearest one, and it's also between the two locations.
And then she also reported stopping at a drugstore?
That's right.
And if we move forward, what do we see on this slide?
This is the first location data point in the, among all the data sets that I had for that day. This is an indication of a GPS location from Charles Vallow's phone. And you'll see right there on the left-hand side, True by Hilton at 1950 South Santan Village Parkway.
And what are we seeing here?
This is an overlay of a receipt that was later recovered when we went to the True by Hilton that indicates that that is, in fact, where Mr. Vallow was staying on the date in question. So, as I mentioned, we're trying to see if data appear to be accurate or not. This does appear to show him at the hotel where he was known to be staying, or his device at the hotel where he was known to be staying.
And in moving to the next slide, what are we seeing here?
So this is a record from the 0143 number attributed to Chad Daybell, where it texts the 9562 number attributed to Lori Vallow. As I mentioned, for that 9562 number, I don't have text logs. So to the extent that I can examine those communications, it has to be viewed from the records produced regarding the 0143 number. And this here would be the estimated location of that 0143 number at the time, which is 6:06 in the morning, Arizona time.
And if we go to the next slide?
This is advancing the time to 6:12 in the morning. And this is Lori Vallow's 9562 number texting Chad Daybell 0143 number.
And this is again on July 11th of 2019?
That's right.
And if we go to the next slide?
Advancing again to 7:01 in the morning, the Chad Daybell 0143 number texts the Lori Vallow 9562 number. And these are just, again, the mapping estimates associated with each of these communication events for the 0143 number.
And moving forward, what do we see here?
This is starting back at that 0003 GPS event, and it showed the various GPS events all the way up to 0716. If you saw them popping up on the screen and then passing, it would show that they were all generally in the area of that hotel until 7:16 in the morning on the 11th.
And then if we move to the next couple slides.
So at 7:16 in the morning, the device, Charles Vallow's device location data shows it traveling from that Hilton through various streets to the area of the Four Peaks residence. And one of the things I wanted to highlight here, as I mentioned, all data has an error rate, yes. I do not have any reason to believe that Charles Vallow's phone was actually in the backyard of that neighboring house. There's just an error rate, and that's something to keep in mind when one reviews these things. But it shows it arriving in the area of the Four Peaks residence at 7:32 in the morning.
And the last communication between Chad and Lori prior to this that you noticed was about 7:01 or just after 7 in the morning?
That's right. On that device, yes.
And if we move forward, what are we going to see here?
This is going to show, again, the 0143 number texting Lori Vallow's 9562 number, and this is at 7:33 in the morning. This is the same approximate time that the device data indicates that Charles Vallow's device arrived near Four Peaks.
And again, we don't have the content of those messages. Is that correct?
I do not have those. If someone has them, I'm not aware of it.
And this is a device associated with Chad texting a device associated with Lori?
That's right. And I'm not familiar with the area, of course, but I imagine those of you up here are more likely to recognize this area.
And if we move forward?
So until 7:50, the data from Charles Vallow's device indicates it was in the general area of the Four Peaks address. Then about 7:50, you see that it has now moved away and out towards the surface street, which is Gilbert Road. So that's approximately 18 minutes after the device arrived near Four Peaks. It is now off and in transit, and about 46 minutes prior to the time when the 911 call will occur.
And you previously indicated it was stated Lori Vallow ended up in possession of Charles' phone?
Yes, that's the claim she made, and that's also how it was later recovered by one of the detectives, was from Ms. Vallow.
And if we... Actually, I'm looking at the time. Judge, would you like us to keep going?
Well, I think we ought to go ahead and take the noon recess at this time, Ms. Blake. So we'll go ahead and take lunch. Let's start back up right at 1 o'clock, please.
All right, please.
Thank you. Please be seated.
There's more to come in the trial of Chad Daybell. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our continuing coverage right here from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.